Luke 6:6 through 6:16. The 27th talk in a series on the Gospel of Luke was presented by Jack Crabtree on March 13, 2005 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
A little bit of review. This is sort of an awkward section to teach because I'm going to be finishing one section of the book and going on to a whole different section. There's not enough to say to fill up the morning on the first section, so we're going to have to bridge the two. But let me just review a little bit where we're coming from. There's a section that started with the account of calling Matthew, which in of itself is sort of problematic, calling Matthew to be his disciple, because Matthew is a tax gatherer, a tax collector, is one of the outcasts in Jewish society, a social outcast. He's the scum of the earth. He's being invited by Jesus to be among his disciples. And then we move from there into Jesus telling the parable about the wineskins, the new wine and the wineskins. And the point that he was making there is that the ideas that you believe, the theology that you have, your worldview, your perspective on things is going to dictate your practices. And the problem is you can't just patch old practices onto a new worldview. You can't just change your ideas and not change your practices. It doesn't work that way. Well, something's going to have to give. And by implication, what he's saying is, I've come into the world to teach people a whole different way, a whole new paradigm for how they understand a human being's relationship to God. And because I'm teaching them a whole new paradigm, they're going to act differently. They're going to behave differently. And that's why he says that my disciples are behaving differently than the Pharisees and behaving differently than the disciples of John. He then goes on to heal on the Sabbath. They're eating grain on the Sabbath. And in that context, Jesus makes the point to the Pharisees that you have to make a distinction between religion, religious observance, and moral practice, moral behavior. Moral behavior should always take priority over religious observance. God did not come into the world to make us into religious people. He came into the world to call us to be people who want to emulate the goodness of God. And it's always right to do good, even if that means you violate some religious rule, some religious observance that you have been asked to do. Because religion is not so important that you violate goodness in order to practice your religion. So it's in that context then that we come to this next section. He's really still making the same kind of point in this section, but we have some interesting features here in the account that follows. So in 6:6, now it happened on another Sabbath that he entered the synagogue and was teaching, and there was a man there whose right hand was withered. The scribes and the Pharisees, in order that they might find a reason to indict him, were watching him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. But he knew their thoughts, so he said to the man who had the withered hand, "Get up and stand here among us." And he got up and stood among them. And Jesus said to them, "I ask you, which is lawful to do on the Sabbath, to do good or to do harm, to save a life or to destroy it?" After looking around at them, he said, "Stretch out your hand." So he did so, and his hand was restored. But they themselves were filled with rage and discussed together what they might do to Jesus. Now he starts here, I've translated it, "Now it happened on another Sabbath that he entered the synagogue and was teaching." It could very well be that he phrases it the way he does because this is not something that simply happened next in chronological temporal order. It could be that this is selected out because it follows up the same theme that's being developed from the time of the call of Matthew and the parable and the account about the disciples eating grain on the Sabbath, that it's just one more account that gives evidence of what Jesus had to say and what he thought about the rules of the Pharisees as opposed to his teaching. And that could be the only, the thing that's interesting, however, is that Matthew, Mark, and Luke all have this account following the account of the disciples eating grain on the Sabbath. So it's interesting that they have selected the same material if that's the case. You'd think if they were exercising some kind of editorial discretion that there might be some difference here, but all three of the Synoptic Gospels have this following it. So it may very well be that it happened in close proximity and that Jesus himself was developing a theme in his teaching, in his own strategy for getting the message out in Galilee, that he himself was following a theme. I don't know how to read that. But in all likelihood, it probably happened shortly after the other account that we just looked at. So it happened on another Sabbath that he entered the synagogue and was teaching. We learned elsewhere in the Gospels that that was his custom, that was his habit. The early part of his ministry was largely through synagogue teaching. He would go into the synagogue on a Sabbath day, and when they invited people to stand up and, actually don't stand up and teach, to sit down and teach, because when you were teaching, you always taught from a seated position. When they invited the people to come and teach, Jesus would accept the invitation and he would teach the people in the synagogue. So that's happening again. He's teaching in the synagogue. He notices that there's a man there whose right hand was withered. Now, what exactly does withered mean? I assume it's referring to a hand that is just drastically atrophied because of the paralysis. It has not been used, and it just is not a normal hand, but it's all shriveled up and haggard looking because there's no muscle in the hand. We'll come back to that in a second. In the synagogue, it says, the scribes and the Pharisees, in order that they might find a reason to indict him, were watching him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. Jesus has already broken the Sabbath. Presumably, he's already healed on the Sabbath. Otherwise, I don't think it would occur to them, although he has already healed, so maybe they're just simply seeing, is he going to heal today, which is a Sabbath day, which would be in violation of our rules. They're not there because they're open to knowing the truth about this man, Jesus. They're not there because they want to know whether they should follow him. They're there from the get-go to indict him, it says, to find a reason to indict him. So their hearts are hard. Their hearts are stubborn. Their hearts are darkened. And they're men who believe evil ideas and believe evil theology. And Jesus is an obstacle and a threat to their evil theology. So they simply want him dishonored, discredited, and ultimately we're going to see they want him gone. They want him dead, as we'll see by the end of this. But they're there to try to find a reason to somehow remove Jesus as a threat. It goes on to say, but he knew their thoughts, so he said to the man who had the withered hand, get up and stand here among us. Now, says he knew their thoughts. It's difficult to know in the case of Jesus, when does he know what he does? Because he's a wise, discerning, observant human being. And when does he know what he knows? Because he's the Messiah, the Son of God, and out of a special relationship to God, has prophetic knowledge, if you will, the knowledge the way a prophet has knowledge. It seems relatively clear to me here, that he probably simply knows that the way you and I would know that. I mean, when you've got people as hostile as these people are, they probably shouted that through their body language all over the place. So he doesn't have to be the Son of God to know what he knows here. So he knew their thoughts. He knew their agenda. He knew their purpose. He knew what they were doing. He said, so what does he do? He said to the man who had the withered hand, get up and stand here among us. And the man got up and stood among them. Everyone would have been seated, including Jesus. So he's asking him to stand in their midst and be noticeable. And Jesus said to them, I ask you, which is lawful to do on the Sabbath, to do good or to do harm, to save a life or to destroy it? Now here, Jesus is raising a rhetorical question that fits hand in glove with the point that he's just made in the last account about when he was defending his disciples for eating grain on the Sabbath. He raises it in a very simple way. Which is lawful to do on the Sabbath, to do good or to do harm? And by that simple question, he's simply raising the question, what's the priority, religion or morality? Could it possibly be that God wants you to keep the Sabbath, to keep that religious observance so badly that he would have you do harm to another human being on the Sabbath in order to keep your Sabbath rule? Does that make any sense whatsoever? Or is it always right to do good on the Sabbath? Couldn't it be the case that acting on the Sabbath to emulate the goodness of God would always be honoring to God and would always be obedient to God? Wouldn't that follow? I think that's how Jesus would answer that, because to do good is always right. What the Pharisees had done, if you will recall, is that they had misunderstood the Sabbath. Instead of seeing it as the celebration of the covenant that God made with the people of Israel, and that they were to observe it by simply setting that day aside, making it a special day where they did not engage in their everyday vocation and occupation and daily maintenance of their existence, but they set that aside to celebrate the covenant that God made with them. The Pharisees had decided that what God really didn't like was effort. And on the Sabbath day, God was prohibiting you from doing anything that took any effort whatsoever. So you needed to do everything you could to avoid sweat and labor and effort. Well, that missed the whole point. It wasn't God's allergy to effort that had dictated the celebration of the Sabbath. It was the delight and joy of the promise that God had made to Israel that he wanted to make sure that they remembered and be reminded of and celebrate and see as a very, very momentous event that was that spelled the meaning and purpose of their lives. It was that remembrance that he was after. If in the course of the day there was some reason to exert effort, that's fine, as long as you're not going about your daily maintenance of your life through your vocation and occupation. In other words, as long as you're not making it just one more ordinary mundane day. But it wasn't a problem if there was effort. Even the Pharisees themselves had an exception on the Sabbath day, at least some of the rabbis, that if an ox falls in a ditch, you can pull it out on the Sabbath. And Jesus at some point uses that with respect to them. Even you yourself recognize that there are some things that you just need to do to expend effort on the Sabbath because it's the right and good thing to do. So he just raises that question here. I ask you, which is lawful to do on the Sabbath, to do good or to do harm, to save a life or to destroy it? They didn't answer. After looking around at them all, he said to him, "Stretch out your hand." So he did so, and his hand was restored. Okay, two things are noteworthy here. I think what happens is he stretches out his hand, and to do so, apparently, it has to no longer be paralyzed for him to be able to stretch it out at all. And in the process of stretching it out, it's called restored. I think what had to happen, I think what it's describing, is this atrophied hand miraculously and supernaturally was restored to a state of health and vigor as if it had been a usable hand for years and years and years. In other words, strong muscle fiber, lots of muscle fiber. Instead of this haggard, shrunken, withered hand that had been there, you had a healthy, normal hand. That's a remarkable miracle. And we need to keep that in mind when we hear in our day and age all of the miracle reports that people suggest are all around us. The miracles that Jesus did were truly remarkable and functioned as real evidence for his authority. It wasn't rumor. It wasn't hearsay. It wasn't something that could be coincidence or psychosomatic or any number of other things. You know, it wasn't you're praying for me and my cold suddenly goes away, which colds can do. It was going from a withered hand instantaneously to a restored hand, a healthy hand, something that just is inexplicable in any sort of normal circumstances. So that's the order of the miracle that we're seeing here. The other thing that's remarkable about this, however, is Jesus' aggressiveness here. This is in the face of the Pharisees. It would be so easy for him to have known the thoughts of the scribes and Pharisees and to said, they're just gunning for me. They just want an excuse to blame me and discredit me and dismiss me. I'm not going to give it to them. I'll just teach and leave it at that, and I won't do anything to outrage them or violate their scruples or their sensibilities here. He could have done that. You and I probably would have done that for the most part. But Jesus courageously and outrageously, if you will, is completely in their face. You think it's wrong to heal on the Sabbath? Well, watch me. And he simply steamrolls right over their religious sensibilities here. Does that have anything to say to us? I think many Christians, perhaps most Christians, would say, no, don't you be emulating here what Jesus is doing. And their argument would be, because he's Jesus. Jesus can do that because he's Jesus, but don't you do that because you're not Jesus. On the surface, that sounds credible, and maybe there's something to that. But we have to remember, there are two kinds of things that Jesus does. Some things I can't possibly emulate because indeed he is Jesus. He's the Son of God. I can't perform the miracles that he did. I can't claim to have a unique relationship to God as he did. There's all kinds of ways in which Jesus is above us and other than us and different than us. On the other hand, Jesus was clearly presented to us to be a model, to be an example that we are to follow. I don't know any other way to read the temptations of Jesus in the wilderness than to recognize that we are to understand and emulate his interaction with evil. We should interact with evil in exactly the way he interacted with evil, the temptation to evil. We should interact with lies and deceptions the same way he interacted with lies and deceptions. We don't dismiss that and go, well, that's easy for him. He's Jesus, or that's the way Jesus did it because he's Jesus, but I'm different. No, we're a human being, and he was simply being a ideal human being in that situation. Well, what are we thinking when we say, well, he can do that, he's Jesus here? On the one hand, it seems to me that if it's right for Jesus to be offensive and outrageous in being in the face of the Pharisees here, then don't we have to conclude that there's nothing inherently and intrinsically wrong with being outrageously offensive to people in certain contexts? Otherwise, if Jesus is being unloving here or being unwise here, it seems to me it challenges what we all assume, or what I assume about in my Christology, that Jesus was a perfect human being, sinless and wise. Well, if his sinlessness and wisdom did not rule out him being outrageously confrontational here, then there must not be something inherently wrong with being outrageously confrontational in the right time, place, and context. On the other hand, I think the people who would object would say, well, that's all well and good, but the problem is you need to be able to know your motives. It's easy enough for Jesus because he's perfect and his motives are perfect. So of course he was doing it out of love and could know that he was doing it out of love and wisdom, because he's not even fallible. He's not even capable of doing it any other ways, but we are. We're capable of being outrageously offensive because we are evil, competitive, jealous, envious, power hungry, have a lust for victory and competition. I mean, there are just all kinds of motives that can drive us that could make us be confrontational and outrageous, but are not wise and are not loving. And since we are so vulnerable to that, and since that's such a real possibility, we need to just simply steer clear altogether. We shouldn't do what Jesus is doing here, because in all likelihood, we're doing it bad. Well, that's an important caution, and that's well taken. But I'm reminded of the way Paul responds to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians. The Corinthians are accusing Paul of ulterior motives, evil ambition of one kind or another. And Paul's response to them is, I'm not aware of anything against myself. That is, I think what he's saying is, as I search my own heart, as I search my own soul, I don't think that's right. I think what's driving me is a love of God and a love of the truth and a love of Jesus and a love of the gospel. I think that's what's driving me. So I'm not aware that your charges against me make any sense. From inside, I think you're wrong. On the other hand, he says, I am not by this acquitted. He's saying, but I'm not my own judge. I don't get to call that. I don't get to be the one who has the last say on whether or not I'm guilty. God will be the judge of that. God who knows all, God who knows truly, God who knows without deception, he's the one who's going to have to finally make that call. So I'm not by that acquitted. But then he goes on to say, but the one who must judge me is God. Something like that. Well, it seems to me that in looking at what Jesus is doing here, ultimately, we need to recognize that there may very well be a time and place where we are called upon to be in the face of the religious scruples of other people in an aggressive and outlandishly confrontational kind of way. That may very well be. We must make sure that our motives are pure or have integrity in any case. And we must be able to know in our own heart that that we have nothing against ourselves with respect to why we're doing what we're doing. But in the final analysis, it's the Lord who needs to sort all that out. And we can seek to emulate the model of our Lord here as best we can, as sincerely as we can, as honestly and authentically as we can, and let God sort it out in the end. But I think it's important to know here that there's nothing inherently wrong with stepping on other people's toes. Notice that the way we would tend to evaluate this, by the standards that we would tend to apply to one another, Jesus failed here. In 90, he says, but they themselves were filled with rage and discussed together what they might do to Jesus. Our tendency, because of our fearfulness, our tendency is to conclude Jesus really blew it here. Jesus was really foolish. I mean, look what happened. He just made them mad and want to kill him. Where did that get him? You know, what good did that do? And our tendency would be to, in applying that to our own lives, to think, well, if I just make people mad and make them walk away in a huff or hate me or something like that, I've closed the door and they will never listen to me again. I mean, we're very keen on wanting to keep the lines of communication open. And so don't do anything to close off the lines of communication so that they won't hear us or can't hear us any longer. Well, notice that Jesus isn't paying attention to that. Yeah, he closed the lines of communication big time here. He totally trashed them. He doesn't have these scribes and Pharisees' ear at all. They're not going to listen to a word he says. They hate him. They want to destroy him. They're plotting to kill him because of what he did. But unless we're prepared to accuse Jesus of being a foolish, sinful, short-sighted human being, then we have to conclude that there isn't anything inherently and intrinsically wrong with doing something that may lose a hearing. Why did he lose a hearing? Not because he did anything wrong. not because he did anything unwise, not because he did anything unloving. It's because he was dealing with evil people who believed evil ideas and weren't prepared to rethink those ideas. They loved those evil ideas, and they weren't about to have them challenged. That's why they wouldn't listen to him. They weren't prepared to listen to him anyway. It didn't really make any difference whether he offended them or not. Not offending them wasn't going to help. They were closed to the ideas anyway. I mean, we saw ahead of time, why were they there? To look for evidence against him. They weren't there to give him a fair hearing and figure out whether what he said was true or not. So I do think we have to understand there comes a time when religious people are the enemies of truth, and particularly religious people can be the enemies of truth. And as much as on the surface it may sound like and seem like religious people are my target audience, are the fertile field, the field ripe for harvest, and that's true for some of them. But there is a whole set of religious people who are the enemies of the truth. And I cannot make them happy, I cannot keep them happy, and there's no wisdom in trying to keep them happy. They are going to be outraged, they are going to be offended, and that's the appropriate thing to do. But unlike Jesus, I need to be on my guard. Actually, that's not true. Like Jesus, I need to be especially on my guard that my motives are right, that it is a question of truth, and it's about truth, not about me in the process. Okay, well, that ends that section, and now he's going to go on to, in this new section, to a whole new set of ideas and events, starting with 6:12. Now, it happened in those days that he went up on the mountain to pray. Indeed, he spent the whole night in prayer to God, and when day came, he called his disciples to him, and choosing 12 of them, he named them apostles: Simon, whom he also named Peter, and Andrew his brother, and James, and John, and Philip, and Bartholomew, and Matthew, and Thomas, and James, the son of Alphaeus, and Simon, the one called the Zealot, and Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. We don't know this from Luke's account, but from the other gospel accounts, probably part of the reason that he goes up on the mountain to pray is things are beginning to get really crazy in Jesus' life at this point. We're going to see here, if you move down to 18 or so. Now, there was a large crowd of his disciples along with a great throng of people from all of Judea and Jerusalem and the coastal region of Tyre and Sidon. In the other Gospels, we learn that they're from beyond the Jordan and Syria and Perea, and there are people from all over the Middle East, really, who have heard about Jesus and are thronging to the northern shores of the Sea of Galilee to hear him teach and be healed. And I expect the emphasis is on the latter rather than the former, to hear him teach and be healed. They're more interested in the healing probably than the teaching, but they're there because this is a remarkable man, they hear. Well, they are thronging there from all over the region, and things are getting really crazy. So for a little respite and a little quiet and a place where he can reflect, he goes up onto a mountain. It says that he went up on the mountain to pray. What is he going up on the mountain? Why is he going up on the mountain to pray? As we are going to see here, after the night of prayer, he calls the disciples to himself and he appoints 12 to be apostles. It seems to me that they're related, that he's not just going up on the mountain to pray as a kind of spiritual discipline or as a spiritual routine that he follows. This is an unusual event. This is a very momentous event in Jesus' life. He's going to choose the 12 people who are, after he's gone, going to be his authoritative spokesmen, are going to represent him and his teaching to the world. I think he has a sense that he needs to get this right. In a sense, all of human history is on the line here. If he chooses rightly, the gospel will be well represented and can spread in the world. If he chooses wrongly, something else is going to happen. So I think any of us, if we were in his position, would recognize the weight and the burden of the moment. I need to get this right. So he spent the whole night in prayer to God, it says. Jesus, I think, believed two things, as should we. On the one hand, every decision we make, and some, of course, are more obviously momentous than others, and yet you never know what little choice you make is going to be a momentous choice. You know, one little mistake in judgment can change everything for eternity. And we don't know, we're not in a position to know what that judgment might be, what that choice might be that I make that's going to be so momentous. On the other hand, sometimes we ourselves can see ahead of time the momentousness of the choice, and I think that's what is the case here. But every choice we make is ultimately momentous. The whole future depends on what I decide, what I choose, what I'm going to do. In that sense, biblical Christianity, the worldview of Jesus, is very existential, if you will, accepting the importance of what I do in my freedom, how I invest my freedom, is going to shape and define my being and my existence, on the one hand. On the other hand, Jesus also believed that the will of God was going to be done. Nothing could change it, nothing could thwart it, nothing could interfere with it. Exactly what God wanted to occur was going to occur. And both are true. And to understand our relationship with God and our decision-making in the light of the sovereignty of God and the determinative power of God over reality, we have to understand both things. I am not a fatalist. We must not be fatalist. Jesus is not a fatalist. It's not that it makes no difference what he decides. And we see that here. Why would he be burdened to spend a whole night in prayer if he was a fatalist? I could pick any 12 at random and it would all work out all right. It would be just fine. It's not his perspective. It's not that he can pick any old 12 Jewish men and it'll be okay. He wants to get it right. And he wants the wisdom and he wants the insight to get it right on the one hand. On the other hand, we don't see that in this account, but we see it in so many other accounts that Jesus had the perspective, but of course the will of God would be done. Well, how do you put those together? The way you put those together is to recognize that as I, in my freedom, make this momentous choice that I am burdened with and that I must make, I can make it with the confidence that whatever choice I end up making in my freedom is what God has ordained, what God has willed, what God wants, which gives me the freedom to make that momentous choice. Otherwise, who of us is not paralyzed? If the whole future depends upon my choice, who would want to choose? And yet, what gives us the confidence to choose is knowing that in the end, ultimately, I can't go wrong. I must take the choice seriously because everything hinges on it. And yet, I must not fear the choice because I can't go wrong. That's the situation, I think, that we find Jesus in here. So, having spent the night in prayer, I think, presumably, about who is it that he should choose, he calls his disciples to himself. And remember, his disciples are a larger group of men and women who have been following him and listening to him teach and watching him, observing his miracles and so on. But he called all his disciples to him, and he chose 12 of them that he named apostles. Couple of issues here. Why 12? What's the significance of 12? And what are these apostles? An apostle, I think I've defined before, but let me just review that. An apostle is simply someone that you send with the authority, having delegated the authority to basically speak for you. In Jesus' case, he was the light of the world that came into the world to dispel the darkness and the ignorance of mankind with the truth of his that he had received from his Father. He wanted He wanted the truth to be let loose into the world to change the world. Well, but he hung around with a relatively few people teaching them and trying to convince them of what the truth was. What's going to happen when he's gone? Well, he appointed apostles to be people who could authoritatively go elsewhere in the world and teach what Jesus taught with the authority to say, this really is what Jesus was trying to say to us. That's the role that these men are going to play. I can't tell what the scope of these 12, what the scope of their ministry was. There are many traditions in the church about Thomas going to India and Andrew going to Russia and here and there, all these different apostles going all over the world to different places and proclaim the gospel to people. It's difficult to know, though, whether those traditions are based on anything, right? Whether they're really historical, and I just don't know. It may very well have been that in the final analysis, their role was to minister to the Jews in Palestine, and that it was really Paul, the apostle to the Gentiles, who really broke out of Palestine and took the gospel message around the world, Paul and those whom he converted. I don't know. I just don't know the truth of the matter. But either way, I think the thing to one of the things to recognize is he's calling these, he's choosing 12 and calling them apostles. But even though he's choosing 12 and calling them apostles, that does not imply that there are only 12 apostles and can only be 12 apostles. It just simply doesn't mean that. So I think Paul can legitimately claim to be an apostle sent from Jesus. What's required to be an apostle is that you get an appointment from Jesus and that you have received the Spirit of truth to equip you to speak authoritatively for Jesus himself, having been commissioned to do so. That's what makes somebody an apostle. It's not being a member of this group of 12. This particular group of 12, I think, is largely symbolic. The reason for 12, I think, is because it corresponds to the 12 tribes of Israel. That is, it's a way of talking about the full complement, representing the full complement of the people of God. But this is a new people of God. This is not just the people of God, the children of Abraham, who have a special role to play in history. This is the people of God that are going to inherit the blessing of Abraham and enter into all of eternity to remain eternally the people of God in the kingdom of heaven. And it's these 12 men that symbolically represent the full complement of the people of God in that sense, I think. Who are these 12? Simon, whom he also named Peter, and Andrew his brother, and James and John. Well, we met them before. James and John, if you remember, were the sons of Zebedee. Their mother was a close disciple of Jesus. Simon Peter and Andrew were fishermen who apparently had some connection with the fishing business that Zebedee owned. Either they were, you know, managers and foremen who worked under him and were trusted employees or servants, or they were co-owners. It's difficult to know for sure, but they had some very close connection with both James and John and James and John's father, Zebedee. Zebedee was apparently a relatively wealthy man. There are indications that John had relatives who owned land in Jerusalem. So this had apparently been a very, very successful business that had gained Zebedee a significant amount of wealth and social acceptance in Jerusalem, which was the heart of Jewish culture. So, and then to what extent Peter and Andrew share in that wealth is not clear, but they're certainly close associates of James and John. Then we have Philip, who is clearly a very good friend of Andrew's and apparently comes from the same city. Bartholomew, who is also known as Nathanael. So Nathanael Bartholomew would be Nathanael's son of Ptolemy. Bartholomew just simply being the Greek form of Bartholomew. Nathanael is a good friend of Philip's. So then we have Matthew and Thomas. Thomas, which comes from the word for twin and is apparently a nickname, also known as Didymus, which was the Greek word for twin. Thomas is at the end, after the death and resurrection of Jesus. He's one of the people that is fishing, has gone back and is fishing again when the resurrected Jesus appears to them and does the miracle of the nets all over again. So it may very well be that Thomas has been a servant of Zebedee originally as well. It's hard to know, but at least he's fishing afterwards. So unless he's just taking it up, if he's returning to his original profession, then he too is a fisherman. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of these disciples who not only were in all likelihood all fishermen, but were also known to one another quite intimately. That there are a network of relationships among them that existed before Jesus even came on the scene. Then we have Matthew, who was a tax collector, and it's difficult to know. It's really difficult to know what we're to make of Matthew. Was he the enemy who was being brought into the camp when Jesus chose him to be a disciple and now one of the 12? A tax collector, for the most part, they were hated because they were thieves. They were traitorous thieves. Every now and then, however, a tax collector could be a fair and honest one. And so it could very well be that all seven of these men who are daily paying taxes to Matthew at the poll booth, it could very well be that Matthew is known by them to be an honest man, and they appreciate him and respect him because he's not taking advantage of his role as so many tax gatherers and tax collectors did. I don't know. We just don't know the truth of the matter there. The rest of these people, James the son of Alphaeus, also known in other places as James the Little, James the Small, or they usually translate it James the Lesser. Probably that's by comparison to James, the son of Zebedee, the brother of John, lesser known, less notoriety perhaps, lesser rank, if you will, in the informal rankings among the 12, maybe smaller in stature, maybe younger. Sometimes translations have it James the Younger. But we don't know much about him. Just there's this other one of the 12 named James, who is the son of Alphaeus. There's another one named Simon, called the Zealot. I don't know if we've talked about the Zealots or not. The Zealots apparently began in Galilee under a guy named Judas the Galilean, who Josephus considers to be the beginner, the one who began a whole different sect within Judaism. And the sect that he started believed that it was idolatrous and wrong to give any kind of support and recognition of the Gentile governing authorities. There should be no one that we worship and honor and serve but God. So we can't offer any honor and service to the Roman emperor. And out of his teaching arose different splinter groups, but one of these groups was called the Zealots. And the Zealots were a pain in the side of Rome from then on. They would mount insurrections and riots, and they opposed Rome in any way that they could. And finally, Rome got tired of going to battle against the Zealots, that finally brought Titus in, and he wiped out the temple completely and just trashed Jerusalem and was done with it. But it was largely at the instigation of the Zealots. There was another group closely related to that called the Sicarii. And they were called the Sicarii after a little weapon, a dagger, that they would conceal in their loose clothing. And they would go into the marketplace and knife to death any Jew that they thought was a collaborator with the Romans and then escape into the crowd. They're some of the beginning, initial terrorists. The Sicarii were just a fairly radical marginal group of zealots. Well, Simon is the one called the Zealot because he has been a member of some kind, an associate of some kind of the Zealots. So a radical political figure has been his past. Judas, the son of James, we only know him as the other Judas. We don't know much about him beyond that. And then finally, Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. We'll probably review this one more time before we're done, but it was interesting in looking at the stuff concerning Judas. In modern times, it's become kind of the kind of hip and groovy interpretation of Judas that he too was a political radical like Simon the Zealot, and that his motive for betraying Jesus was that he, when he recognized that Jesus's goals did not line up with his political goals, Jesus wasn't being political enough, that he decided to use Jesus to his political advantage and try to get Jesus crucified in order to start a riot and an insurrection so that the Jews could finally get fired up enough to throw Rome off. The evidence actually doesn't seem to me point in that direction. It seems to me rather a more likely understanding of what happened to Judas. Judas was the treasurer, the keeper of the money that some of the women disciples came from very wealthy families, and they would contribute money to the upkeep of the band of disciples. Judas was the keeper of those funds, kept them in a leather bag. Some people think his name Iscariot comes from the name of the leather bag, so it means Judas leather bag is his name. He kept those funds, and it would appear that, as we see evidence among all the disciples, so there was a tremendous temptation for the disciples to want to be a follower of Jesus, because given their understanding of things, Jesus was going to be the new political ruler of the Jews. He was going to throw off the yoke of Rome, and he would be king, and he would rule. Well, if you were a close associate of this one who is going to be king, there was power and money in store for you. So one could very well be motivated to be a disciple of Jesus out of a greed and ambition for power and money. And apparently that was the case for Judas. What motivated him to stay close to Jesus? Because he wanted the perks that he thought were going to come from that. Apparently then, when Jesus started to become explicit about, I'm going to go to Jerusalem, and they're going to crucify me, and on the third day I'm going to be raised again. And if you haven't noticed, read through the Gospels, Jesus is as clear as day about what's going to happen to him. It is just astonishing how clear he is. It is equally astonishing how obtuse the disciples were. He said it as plain as can be, and they still didn't really get it. But Judas evidently got it enough to recognize that this wasn't going to work out the way he wanted it to. There's no power and money in it for Judas if Jesus goes and gets himself crucified. So he ultimately decides to get out of this what he can get out of it, as his greed and his avarice and his ambition is motivating him. So he begins embezzling from the treasury. John tells us he begins pilfering money out of the leather bag, and that's one source of money for him. And then apparently the other thing he did is, well, if Jesus says he's going to get crucified anyway, maybe I can turn this into some cash for myself. And apparently takes the opportunity to try to get something out of this, since it's not going to play out the way he hoped it would. That seems to be the more likely motive for Judas. Okay, I'm running out of time. We're about to come on to the section that corresponds in Matthew to the Sermon on the Mount. It's Luke's version of that, but I'll save that for next week. We have just a few minutes here for any questions that you might have.
Jack, I was looking at this question in verse 9, where Jesus says, I ask you, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good? You mentioned that this Jesus healing this man is really in their face. I think that's true, but I also think the question is in their face, because it's a double bind. It's not like they can say, no, we're not interested in good on the Sabbath. And he's framing the question as about what he's about to do as good, and their particular perspective of the Sabbath as evil. So it is really in their face because he's calling them evil, I think.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
I was wondering, when you said the Pharisees had the idea that God just didn't like any effort or sweat, or whatever, on the Sabbath, could it also be, I mean, I just think of people being raised with this one more rule that they have, and there's a lot of effort, I'm sure, that went into getting ready for the Sabbath so you wouldn't be breaking it when it came. And then, well, I just think of, like, from a child's point of view, they're raised by their parents to not do anything, you know, on the Sabbath, and that would have been seen with resentment from an immature, childish point of view. And so it could it have come to be something that this was another kind of effort, just whatever way they ceased from doing their normal stuff. They were missing the point. And I think, and maybe that's a modern idea I have, but I think people who try to at least follow that principle are thinking, okay, well, God has given me this day to rest, but I have to do this certain way. And so that becomes kind of an effort in that.
Stressful in terms of stress and anxiety. It doesn't really, it's not very restful. Yeah.
I had two questions, actually. The first is, do we have any stories about why Judas was chosen as one of the disciples?
No.
Not really? And then
I think there are indications that Jesus may have known all along that he was the one that was going to betray him. Mm-hmm. I don't think that was why he was chosen, though. So, yeah, we don't really have any indication why any of them were chosen. So, not Judas either.
And the second one is, it does seem that Paul is really an apostle in every sense of the word. Why do we have that story in the beginning of Acts where the disciples choose Matthias to be?
Mm-hmm. Well, because I think Paul would not have suited their purposes there, even if they had known about Paul at that point, because he had not. They were looking for someone who had been with Jesus from the beginning and had been an eyewitness of his teaching and his life. I think it's because that group is largely a symbolic group. It's the 12 who are the collection of people who can speak authoritatively about Jesus' teaching, Jesus' life.
So it's more from the witness standpoint rather than a teaching standpoint?
Yeah. And I think the reason we tend to have a problem with that is that we're thinking that the set of apostles is a fixed number. So if somebody gets to be an apostle and fills the 12th spot, then that rules out anybody else being an apostle. But I think that's the wrong way to think about it. God can have however many apostles he wants to have. Jesus can appoint however many apostles he wants to. And if Paul is a 13th, then there are 13 apostles. And if Barnabas is a 14th, then there are 14 apostles. I mean, it's sort of up to Jesus who really is an apostle. But the 12 is, among the apostles, a kind of symbolic group of original disciples who have been with him from the beginning, who represent that body, who represent the people of God who are coming into being through this teaching that Jesus brought into the world. But I think the significance of the 12 is symbolic.
Backing up to the wineskins and cloth, is it possible that Jesus is equating himself to the old wine, the old wineskins, and the old cloth? That it is, in fact, there what they have patched onto the law, what they have added to it, is the piece of cloth that destroys it, the new wine that breaks the skins?
I would say those could go either way, except for in the account in Luke. Remember, at the end of that parable, he says, but nobody after drinking old wine wants the new, for they say the old is good enough. And I think that is his way of describing the seductive nature of the kind of Pharisaical worldview and legalism, that there's something very seductive about it. It seems like a mellow way to relate to God, and the kind of sharp and offensive taste of Jesus' teaching is no match for the seductive mellowness of Phariseeism.
So in this respect, he's not a reformer. He's a rebel.
Right, exactly. He's a revolutionary rather than a reformer. Exactly. Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's an important point. I mean, we have to keep that in mind. There's this tendency, and again, I think it comes out of our fearfulness, to never want to be a revolutionary, to always stop at being a reformer. I don't want you to change anything you're doing or any way you're thinking, but let me just add some ideas to your theology and your doctrine and your paradigm. And I think what Jesus is saying here is some paradigms are so evil and so wrong, they need to be trashed and replaced with that which is true. And that's going to be revolutionary, not simply a reformation and a fixing of the old.
Could you make a distinction? Clearly Jesus was getting in their face. There's other places where Paul is talking about people eating meat sacrificed to idols and that kind of thing, where he's definitely cautioning people you're wrong, I'm going to exercise my freedom. So could you make a distinction between times when it's good to get in people's face and other times when it's not good to get in people's face?
Okay. Well, these men are evil men, and he knows it. And he knows that they are not interested in truth. And so he just simply offends them. What he's talking about in Romans 14 and 1 Corinthians, whatever it is, is what about what he calls the weaker brother? What about the one who simply doesn't know any better, is seeking to know, seeking to understand? His faith is authentic, his faith is real, his faith is genuine, but in his ignorance, he could be led down a destructive path. Don't be doing that, Paul says. You know, don't pay a little bit of attention out of love for your brother. Pay a little bit of attention out of what is the likely effect of your actions on such a person, and guard your actions so that you don't have a negative, destructive impact in his life.
And but would that negative, destructive act be? If it's okay for me to eat meat sacrificed to idols, how am I hurting the weaker brother?
Because he doesn't know that.
So how is he interpreting my behavior?
As playing with immorality, as somehow tolerating immorality in your life, I think. Something like that.
So having a cavalier attitude towards goodness, right. It's not really that big a deal to be good.
Right. And so he's saying, out of love for your brother, do you really want to send a message that you, in all likelihood, know is going to be interpreted in some such way? No, you don't want to do that. But let love take priority over you exercising your freedom. But I think that's a completely different scenario than what we have here.
There was someone who visited the study center once who the issue of our freedom came up. A couple of ladies who were talking about a young friend of theirs who believed it was wrong to go to the movies. And they were laughing at him and dragged him to a movie anyway. And I thought that was the way they described him. He seemed more like a weaker brother than a Pharisee. And it seemed kind of an appalling thing for them to do, to compel him to act against his conscience.
Yes, exactly. That's the sort of thing that I don't think Paul would approve of. Yeah. Okay, I need to let you go after one more.
How do you take what Jesus did up against don't throw your pearls to swine, what he was doing here, lest they get really upset and tear you to pieces?
Trying to remember what that means. You know that? You remember what that means? Your theory is better than my ignorance.
That's a really hard statement, I think. But I have been inclined to not understand him to be saying, you decide who the swine are and you don't bother to teach them because otherwise they might turn on you or something like that. That's almost universally how people understand what that's saying. And maybe that's right, but I don't think so. That doesn't make any sense to me. What I was thinking about was kind of that the emphasis was kind of the other way around, that there are things in the Old Testament about throwing things to the dogs that are the idea is if something is holy, then it's inappropriate for the dogs outside the city, but if it's unholy, you throw it out there and then the dogs can have it and that sort of thing. That I can't remember exactly how I put it together, but I'm inclined to think that the emphasis more is on his saying, when he says, like, don't throw what is holy to dogs and don't throw your pearls before swine, that the idea is the inappropriateness. The emphasis is not on the swine and the dogs. The emphasis is on my perception of what is holy and what is appropriate, that I take things that are holy and treat them as if they're holy, and I don't throw them to the dogs. It was something like that, I think, that was going on. I can't remember exactly. I'd have to go back and look at it. But in that case, I think it doesn't relate at all to what it is.
Can he let you go? One last comment about this set of apostles. I forgot to mention this. It was striking to me, I've never really noticed it before, but it was striking to me that over half of the people that he picks for this band of apostles are probably already in some kind of community with themselves, with each other, before he selects them. It makes sense sociologically that people who are like-minded in their view of God and themselves and so on would have over time found each other and connected with each other and been in relationship to each other. So he comes along and he finds a community of such people that he just says, this is the group that is on the wavelength that is going to hear me and understand and be used by me, and they can learn the truth and communicate that to the world. But I just assumed that, being a good American, that he would have picked them at random or something, you know, diversity and all that. But this is not a diverse group. These are friends. These are people who know each other and are fairly intimate with each other for the most part. Okay, thank you.